I felt like I was capable of winning that sprint. I felt like I was, that Valverde opened up super early and it played right into my hands. And I went from thinking I was going to win this thing to within the last 50 meters, I really just cramped up, total electrolyte deficiency cramp. And if you even watch the race finish, I basically sit down. I couldn't keep my calves turning over, just total cramp. And so it was just this, like, I saw winning the world championships in the last 200 meters of the race. I saw it, I could feel it, and then it was gone.
The big question is this: how do we use cycling as a tool to improve our health, our happiness, and our longevity? That is the question, and this podcast will give you the answers. My name is Anthony Walsh, and welcome to the Roadman Podcast.
Welcome back, Roadman, to another Roadman Podcast. Yeah, there we go, me singing again. Shocking stuff. It's getting almost cliche at this stage for me to say it, but I've got another unreal guest today. You don't get to stand on the podium in the Elite World Championship road race unless you are an absolute hitter. Today, I'm talking to Canadian Michael Woods. It's funny because although I didn't know Mike before this interview, our paths ran parallel for quite a little bit, so I've always followed him with a little bit more interest. Someone that I kind of thought, you know what, with a different rub of the green, maybe that could have been me, or who knows, maybe I was just dreaming. But anyway, he's a super interesting guy, and he takes us inside, you know, not only what it takes to come back from his current injury at the moment, which is pretty horrific, but also the dedication to stand on the World Championship podium and what it's like to inspire a nation. Because let's face it, if you're Canadian and you're listening to this, you're not noted as a cycling culture. And Steve Bauer's there, Ryder Hairstyle's there, Mike Barry, there's been a couple of standout riders through the years, but I can list them on one hand, and Mike is definitely up there as somebody who is inspiring future generations, and that's really cool. Obviously, the mantra on this podcast is health, happiness, and longevity, and we dig a lot into that with Mike as he tries to explain to me how he's going to keep cycling a part of his life long after his World Tour days are over. Fascinating insight into one of the best riders in the world. Before I jump into that, let me just tell you about our Patreon account, because Patreon is how I keep this podcast going. A big thank you to anyone who's already subscribed over on Patreon. And if you haven't, please do check it out. It is patreon.com/Anthony_Walsh. The reason to set up the Patreon, it's to make this podcast sustainable. It's so I can cover costs and keep this podcast coming to you week after week with these top quality guests. So if you're enjoying the content and you're saying to yourself, you know what, it's pretty cool that Anthony's connected me in this conversation with one of the best riders in the world. If you'd be willing to buy me a pint of beer to say thanks, if you'd be willing to buy me a coffee to say thanks for doing that, that's what Patreon is. So I'm going to leave the Patreon link in the description down below, but it's patreon.com/Anthony_Walsh. And you can make a small donation, which might seem small to you, but it means a massive, massive amount to me on this podcast. Thank you, guys, in advance. Now I'm going to jump in to the juicy bit. Canadian Mike Woods from EF Education. Mike Woods, welcome to the Roadman Podcast.
Thanks for having me.
How are you, Mike?
I'm doing well. I'm in lockdown here in Girona at the moment. Sitting in my house. It's pissing rain outside. Longing for some nice weather and a moment when I can get back out on my bike.
How's your injury?
It's coming along quite well. I broke my femur now 6 weeks ago tomorrow. And I'm allowed to start weight bearing tomorrow. So a big milestone tomorrow. And sick of not being able to walk, but I'm really happy with how much progress has been made. I'm really fortunate to have some great sponsors and a team behind me. I've got a UK-based physio that's been allowed to come and visit me on almost a daily basis, as well as a massage therapist that really kind of lightened the load for my wife and helped my recovery. And I've made big inroads, so it's been nice to see that progress.
Mike, I rewind to 2013. I took an awful long drive from Toronto all the way across to Ottawa. Race started at 7 a.m. in the morning. I slept shit on someone's couch the night before, and I went into the climb, position perfect, and then some skinny little lad wearing a Garneau kit hit it right at the base of the climb. 15 minutes later, I was in the car. That skinny little dude was you, and I've had a grudge against you ever since.
Race was this? 2013. Oh, was it
your Wick Garneau?
OBC Grand Prix?
Yes.
Maybe? Yeah.
Did you win that day?
No, I don't think so. Or maybe it wasn't OBC Grand Prix. It was
In a park?
Yeah, it could have been the Gatineau Grand Prix.
And
Bruno, we went 1-2. Bruno Langlois won, and I was second.
And I remember going into it, and we're talking about a mutual friend we have, Anton. I remember Anton coming past me and saying, who let the wheel go? And I was like, yeah, that was me. they just clean rolled me off the wheel.
Yeah, I had no race tactics at that point, but I had the lungs, I had the legs, and I tried to use every feature possible to just make the races hard just so I could prove myself and move up.
So it's funny because although we never really chatted or we were never buddies or anything, because I raced against you a little bit, I kind of followed your journey a little bit closer than I would, a regular World Tour dude. Because even that year, I think I raced Tour of Beauce as well. I can't remember. I think you were top 10 overall in that year.
Yeah. I was a bit heavy, hanging out too much with Bruno Langlois. Bruno is a great guy, but loves the beers. And I still wasn't really focused full-time on cycling, and I was still working full-time and just kind of doing this more for fun as opposed to trying to make it somewhere. And yeah, I look at pictures of me going up Megantic Tour de Beauce, which is the main climb.
Oh, dude, that climb's so hard.
Yeah, and just looking at pictures and comparing them to me now, I was pretty overweight, but I still managed to do well and turn some heads and start progressing in the sport.
But had you got a clue back then? Did you dream that it was going to be this big?
Yes and no. I started with the quiet. I didn't tell anybody really this, minus my coach at the time, that I was getting into the sport because I wanted to try and make the Olympics. I achieved the Olympic standard for the 1500 meters, the B standard for the 1500 meters, but just kept on getting injured and running, and so I was just chasing after this dream still of going to the Olympics, and cycling would fit that goal would enable me to get it to the Olympics. And so I started with that ambition, but started kind of as I started riding, started realizing how difficult that would actually be. But along the road, I was fortunate enough to run into a couple of people, particularly when my first year where I was really racing properly on Garneau. I ran into my now coach Paul Sadania, who told me to quit my job, focus on cycling. He'd sort out some funding for me, and it was because of guys like him that I'm now on the World Tour.
Because before you went to Garneau, you had a successful running career. You were 2005, I think, were you the junior Canadian fastest mile, fastest 3,000 meters, and I think you're fastest in the world at some point, U23.
Yeah, as a junior, I ran the fastest time in the world for the mile, won the Pan American Junior Championships, and was supposed to be the next big thing in cycling, but I just didn't have the right mindset at that time. I was too invested in cycling. Too invested in running. Too invested in the wrong things. I was overtraining. My dad was terrible. I had bad guidance, and I was 19, 20
years old. Was your dad coaching you?
My diet.
Oh, your diet. Sorry, I said your diet was terrible. I was like, this is going to get heavy right here.
My parents were fantastic. I'm really fortunate to have great parents. They've always just been super supportive. But my diet was not great. And there are a lot of factors that led to me just continually breaking my left navicular bone to the point where I couldn't race anymore.
With your sort of World Tour knowledge on diet and preparation and everything like that, do you think if you had applied that to running, we'd be looking at a very different outcome?
Certainly. I'm, especially with the support network that I have now, the coaching that I have now, and just the experience and confidence that I have now. I didn't have that when I was 19. And for a number of reasons, I didn't have that. But I'm fortunate that I didn't have that, because I wouldn't have found cycling in the end. And for me, it's been a really, really nice turn of events to be in this sport and enjoying as something that, you know, like as you explained to me earlier, how you love riding, and I'm in the same category. I love what I do, and I feel really fortunate to be in this sport.
So you kind of went off my radar then from, I finished up in 2014 kind of chasing that dream, and you kind of went off my radar then. I wasn't paying much attention. I think you went to Kelly Benefits or something like that, but you popped back onto my radar, I think it was 2016, on Wollongong Hill. Was it 2016?
Yeah.
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 And I was like, what the fuck? How did he get so strong?
Yeah, I went on a bit of a journey, to be honest. Had some setbacks. When I was riding for Garneau, I was doing okay, but I certainly didn't turn enough heads to really step up. Although Garneau was a continental team, they weren't professional in any way, shape, or form. Great continental, great development team, but they weren't at the same level as a Kelly Benefits or Rally, or now, well, Optum at the time, and now Rally. They certainly weren't that tier of continental team. And just before I had a real opportunity to turn some heads, I was scheduled to do the World Tour races in Montreal and Quebec, represent the national team, and then even potentially do the Worlds in World Championships in Florence. I broke my collarbone. And so I wasn't able to go to those events. Had some interest prior to the breaking of the collarbone, but all of a sudden those interests dried up. Teams like strong continental teams like 5 Hour Energy at that time, Mike Creed's Smart Stop, and Rally all had expressed interest, but no one signed me. And then I heard word that Garneau was going to do more of a focus on crits. So I was kind of left in this position where it was maybe I should no longer race or, move on. But then I was kind of thrown a lifeline by Amorevita, this Italian continental team, which was kind of like the last chance of cycling. They had a Canadian director at the time, and they made me this ridiculously good offer that eventually they wouldn't follow up on. But they told me to come out to Europe and come to Italy, and I could race in all these great races. It ended up being this crazy, insane experience. One I don't regret, but
everyone always has insane experiences when they sign for Italian teams.
Yeah, particularly from Amorevita, it was insane. Just from all levels, there was corruption. You know, crazy stuff happening. Guys getting popped for doping, and our bikes never worked, and just the laundry list of crazy things that happened. However, in other ways, it was a lifeline. Like I got this opportunity to race in Europe. I learned a lot, and because of it, I came out a better rider. Halfway through the season, I managed to transfer off the team and go to an American-based team called 5 Hour Energy, and then got the ball rolling from there. Really did well at the World Tour races in Montreal, Quebec, and managed to sign for Optum the following year. And on Optum, that's when I really earned my spot on Cannondale the year following. Tour of Utah and came second overall.
So when you finally got to Cannondale, you've had a bit of a journey to get there. You're not young.
No, exactly. And I think in many ways it was, I didn't have to go through that journey as a runner. I was kind of the I guess I wouldn't say level of Remco Evenepoel, but I was, you know, of that tier almost where you're just getting recruited by everybody. Everybody wants you, and you don't have to really grind it out. You just get to the top. Because of your potential, but in cycling I didn't have that luxury, just because I was so old, I was so inexperienced, such a poor bike handler that I really had to grind it out. And I think it made me a better cyclist in the end, gave me more perspective, and made me better adapted for what is the world, like what is the most important thing in the World Tour, just being hard, being tough, being able to face adversity.
So what's that step up like? Obviously, I never got to make the step up to World Tour, but you take a race like, you know, Tour de Beauce, where I would have said the last two stages of that, particularly the circuit races, they're tough races and they're technical and there's a lot of corners, a lot of twists. And then you go into the World Tour and you have the nickname, the Rook. I'm not sure if you even like the nickname.
I loved the nickname, the Rook. I loved it.
Tell us how that came about.
Especially because a lot of the guys that were calling me the Rook were significantly younger than me, and so I always loved that But I think that was one of the reasons why I was able to make it to the World Tour too, is I was never ashamed to show that I didn't know a certain aspect of the sport. I was always willing to learn, even if the guy was, you know, 10 years my junior, I'd be willing to listen and glean knowledge from that person. But yeah, the step up was massive. You talked to a race like Tour de Beauce versus the World Tour. The thing with the World Tour that I think a lot of people don't realize is that every guy in the World Tour can win a Tour de Beauce. Just everybody there is a winner. You have to get, in order to get to the World Tour, it's not that you can't be the, it's not about being the best domestique at the lower levels. It's about winning races. So every guy that's in the World Tour has won races at the lower levels and is capable of winning races at the lower levels. And guys who are in the World Tour are great at everything and significantly better at one thing. Like you look at a guy like Swain Tuff, for example, who's I think maybe at that Tour de Beauce or maybe the year previous he was there. But in the World Tour, Swain was a guy that was considered a non-climber. He couldn't climb yet. At a race like Tour de Beauce, he's finishing within the top 10 on Megantic and winning the overall.
We see that here, and like when Cavendish comes back to the UK or something and he races a hilly circuit race, you're like, he's a sprinter and he fucking wins the hilliest circuit races, and you're like, how does that happen?
Exactly. He gets made fun of for being a guy who can't climb within the World Tour, but the guy can climb. I mean, anybody like Kittel, for example, when he was in his prime for sprinting, big boy. But man, he could even get over it. It was shocking how many climbs you could get over. And Greipel, another example of that. It's like everybody can do everything in the World Tour, but what keeps you in the World Tour is being good at everything and then really great at one thing.
But has that sunk in for you yet that you're just name dropping Kittel, Greipel, Cavendish, and that you are one of these lads now?
Well, I wouldn't put myself in the same category as the greatest sprinters in the world, but
you stand on the podium in the Worlds, which we'll get to. You know, you've made it. You're one of the top boys in the world.
Yeah. I mean, I really feel I feel like I still have a lot more to improve on in cycling. It is a bit surreal, especially because my initial goals in cycling were to never get to the level that I'm currently at, and it meant that I did once I achieved the goal of making the Olympics. I really had to kind of sit down and reshift my focus, reshift my what I thought I was capable of. I really enjoy what I'm doing, and I don't spend too much time dwelling on where I stack against other guys. Just focus more on enjoying the process and enjoying racing my bike.
What do you think you're capable of now?
I don't know. I mean, especially under the circumstances, under the current circumstances of the sport, I think things are going to change significantly in the next couple months, in the next years. I'm not sure if that will impact me in a positive or negative manner, but I'm really hoping that the Olympics continues and happens in 2021. I'm hoping the World Championship still goes forward in 2020, and based off of what I've done in the past and how my training was going prior to the injury and how I think I can respond from this injury, those two races, particular two races, I could have success at, and I hope to medal at.
Are we going to have two speeds in the peloton when it comes back? We've some guys like using Girona in total lockdown, just trying their way on Zwift, and even though Italy's been badly hit, the lads over there are still training.
Yeah, totally. It all depends on when we start back up. If we start back up in 4 months, I don't think there'll be two speeds, in the sense that once the lockdowns are lifted and there's some time to get back out and train, 2 months is an adequate period of time for guys to get back up to speed. If anything, those that took some downtime will probably be even more rejuvenated and ready to go. I think it's pretty difficult to maintain form and motivation when you've got nothing on the horizon. But if we were to start, you know, tomorrow, there'd be guys trying to merge on the freeway with mopeds, that's for sure.
Because I see Valverde talking about he just thinks that indoor trainers is just a way to burn out, that he's only doing an hour a day, which is probably a lie, but it made for a good.
I wouldn't be surprised if he is. I think that's not an inaccurate statement, depending on where you are in the season. I think you can a guy like Matt Heyman, who's on the trainer right up to almost the point at which he won Roubaix. But when you're, I think motivation and the mind are super important, and and hard to underestimate in training. And if you're slogging your like flogging yourself on a trainer at this point in the season with no real real goal in mind, it is I think Valverde is right in saying that it's difficult to maintain that and be ready for when the real motivation is needed.
You think mentally more than physically?
Yeah, certainly. Certainly, I think mentally more than physically. I think the World Tour is all about mental strength. It's such a mental game. The margin between the best rider in the World Tour and the worst rider, as I was kind of describing earlier, everyone's good. And so the margin's so slim that abilities are actually quite similar. It's like almost everyone can do 6 watts per kilo for an obscene period of time in the World Tour. And it's more just the guys that are more motivated, the guys that are willing to really hunker down, get on the regime, and be fit and lean coming into a race that can separate themselves. So if you have that ability, that mental bandwidth to really, you know, abstain from eating too many chocolates and focus on, you know, getting the right training in when it matters, you always have an advantage over your competition.
How's your discipline around diet?
At the moment, terrible. I've been let loose. My doctors have told me I'm okay to gain a couple pounds just because they want to make sure that I don't compromise the health, the healing rate of my bone, of my femur.
Do you count calories?
No, I don't. I do count KJs when I'm training as a just a like as a metric for energy output, but I don't count the calories that I'm putting in. I just go more off sensation. But yeah, I think at this period in time, it's going back to that kind of bandwidth for discipline. I'm saving it up for the end of the season if there is one.
Mike Woods, he's a compelling dude to listen to. Welcome to your intermission. This is the moment where we take that little collective exhalation. We go, we gather ourselves, we stick on the kettle, we refill our bottles if we're out on a ride, and we get ready for part two of the podcast. But it's also the place where I remind you that right now is the time to pull out your phone, head over to patreon.com/Anthony_Walsh and buy me a beer or buy me a coffee. It's what keeps this show on the road. Thanks for listening, guys, and let's get back to being mesmerized and hypnotized by stories from the Pro Peloton. Take it away, Mike. Let's rewind to 2018. I'm on the couch drinking a beer and I'm screaming at the couch at the TV, and you have Bardet on your wheel, Valverde on your wheel, Moscon is just taking the cyanide tablet, and you're just cruising on up Innsbruck. Well, I don't know if I'd say cruising on, but that was pretty much a career defining moment, would you say?
Yeah, certainly. I think the a couple weeks earlier I won a stage at the Vuelta, and that fueled some extra confidence going into the World Championships. I felt like I was ready to win at the highest level. I was lean, I was fit, and finally my skills and my understanding of the sport were aligning with my aerobic capacity. Prior to the race, I did a recon of the course, and the first time up going up that the defining climb, the whole climb, I turned to my teammates and said, "This is where I'm going to go, and this is how long I go for." And
how long was the climb? Yeah. Like 4 minutes or something like that.
8 minutes in total, but there's a four minute section where it was just incredibly steep, and that's where I identified where I was going to attack. And I knew that if I rode a certain pace for 4 minutes, it'd be difficult for, especially if I attacked, for a lot of guys to follow. And it was one of those days where you're just on a special day and you're able to execute on a plan, and I did, and went up that climb and did exactly as I planned on doing.
Are you pacing that off the power meter, or are you just like full gas, old school Pantani style, whacking it?
Yeah, definitely not looking at the numbers, just going going by off sensation. I come from a running background, and I produce the majority of my power, my best numbers. I'm actually a mediocre seated climber. I'd hardly make the World Tour if I was just doing seated climbing, but once it gets steep enough and the draft's less relevant, my running background really comes to the fore, and I feel like I'm one of the best standing climbers in the world. And
that's interesting.
Yeah, so when we hit that steep pitch, I knew I really had a shot at doing well.
So coming into the line, it's you, Bardet, and Valverde, like, pinch me there coming in the road. But are you thinking, you know, because I was thinking, looking at it, I remember going, fuck, Mike is fast. Like, I know Valverde's fast, but I was like, Mike is punchy in the finish here. He could win the Worlds. This is pretty crazy.
Yeah, honestly, when I crossed the line, it's funny, I ran into my soigneur right away, John Adams. He's a Canadian guy, but also he works with the national team, but he also is one of our soigneurs on EF. And we were at two opposite ends of the emotional spectrum. I crossed the line and he was just like, oh my god, I can't believe you did this. This was, he was so pumped. And I was devastated. In the first minutes after that race, I was really upset with myself. I felt like I was capable of winning that sprint. I felt like that Valverde opened up super early and it played right into my hands. And I went from thinking I was going to win this thing to win the last 50 meters. I really just cramped up, total electrolyte deficiency cramp. And if you even watch the race finish, I basically sit down. I couldn't keep my calves turning over, just total cramp. And so it was just this, like, I saw winning the world championships in the last 200 meters of the race. I saw it, I could feel it, and then it was gone. I was devastated in the moments after, but after about 10, 15 minutes of collecting my thoughts, I started realizing, wait a second, I still medaled at the world championships. This was still a huge achievement. So I'm the only Canadian besides Steve Bauer to have medaled at the world championships, and he did that in 1984. So it was still a big achievement. Although it was a bit of a missed opportunity, I'm really proud of it.
But when you're a bit removed from it, living out in Girona, is it sinking in, like, just how big a result that is? I lived in Canada for a Canadian girlfriend for a long time, and I was back and forth to Canada and spent a lot of time out there. You know, people turning up on the donut ride on a Sunday morning, like, has it sunk in how big it is for them and how motivating it is? It's nearly inspiring another generation of Canadian cyclists.
Well, I hope so. I hope that it can inspire more people to get on bikes. Cycling, is not a big sport in Canada at all. It's one of the reasons why I didn't get involved in the sport. I bet you if it was as big as it is in Europe, particularly Spain, Italy, France, I would have probably been on a bike much earlier in my life. But it's just not that big of a sport, and I think that's what made me so proud of that moment, was that when I was a kid, what motivated me to want to do the Olympics was watching the Olympics in 96 and seeing Donovan Bailey and the 4x100 meter Canadian team best the Americans and take home gold, and just feeling like I was a part of that victory and feeling that pride as a Canadian was so motivating. It inspired me to want to get into sports, wanting to do the Olympics. And yeah, when I was watching the flag go up at the World Championships, I was really hoping that there's a kid back home in Canada thinking now it's now possible I can achieve success in the world level, and maybe he's motivated enough to get on a bike and maybe take on the world tour in a couple of years.
Yeah, it's pretty cool to think that there's a kid back there trying to drop his mates going up a local hill now, thinking he's Mike Woods and just picturing you attacking Valverde, and that's pretty cool to think.
Yeah, that influences how I race. That's how I want to race. I want to be active. I've lost races because of this style, but it's a style I'm proud of that I try and attack. I want to be aggressive because I just want people to see a Canadian up there. I want people to think, okay, if Woods is doing it, then maybe one day I can do it.
You're a long way from Ottawa now. You're living in Girona. Why did you choose Girona?
Yeah, so Girona's my winter training base, just because I'm now an Andorran resident, but in the summer I'm up in Andorra at altitude.
Tax dodger.
Yeah, certainly for the tax benefits, but also just because it's we've got a place at 2,000 meters, and I really benefit from the altitude camps too. So it's good riding up there for getting some good climbs. But Girona and Andorra, I have to be here. I have to be based in Europe, just because the calendar revolves around is based in Europe, and being back home in Ottawa, it's just not feasible training, you know, I'd say about 6-7 months of the year. It's not, you're not really capable of putting in good hours. It's often wet in the shoulder seasons, and then impossibly cold in the winter.
And I guess access to training partners as well.
Actually, that's the one surprising thing is where I live. Ottawa has become quite a bit of a mecca for pro cycling in Canada. We've got Alex Cataford, who's a pro cyclist riding for Israeli Cycling Academy, who's based out of Ottawa, and Matteo Delsin, who is former national champion and rides for the Pro Continental team.
I was actually teammates with him at Rally. Jeff Hill.
Oh, yeah, awesome. Yeah, so you know Matteo then. Big boy, great guy, and yeah, pro cyclist. So I have a couple guys that I can smash with when I'm back in Canada.
Oh, that's cool. Is Girona getting nearly two? I've been going over to Girona, I think, since 2012. I've probably been getting over 2-3 times a year. Just go ride the bike and chill out and drink some nice coffees. But I often find now that I'm booking my Girona time for off season. I'm going in like October, November, December, January. It's summertime. It just feels like the influx of cycling tourists is nearly getting a bit claustrophobic. What's that like for you?
Yeah, it is pretty incredible, the influx in cyclists. And you're right. My favorite time of the year is probably October here, where the weather is just perfect and it's a lot more quiet, less tourists in general, not just cyclists, but just tourists and yeah, all types of tourists. In the summer too, I'm not in Girona as often. I'm more up in Andorra, but I do. Yeah, it certainly has increased. I think that's going to change a bit now with this pandemic. I think it's going to calm some tourism down a bit, unfortunately, for the economy here. But there's a reason why it's just always popping off here. And although it is a bit suffocating, the riding is second to none. I mean, I've lived in Italy. I've trained in a lot of places in the world. And it's really hard to beat Girona. You've got just the great climbing, great adventure riding, but also really good flat riding, which doesn't exist in many other places. You don't have that variety, and the fact that you can go in every direction. It's not just there's not one exit of the town. There's like, I don't know, 15. You can go literally north, south, east, west, and you're going to find good riding. And I often just find myself doing almost a clockwise rotation of the direction of my rides each week. And I've been here now for 5 years, and I laid down a big block here over the course of the winter and was still finding new roads that were just amazing. That's and then amazing. Finally, the traffic second to none, coming from Canada where you're getting buzzed and honked at all the time, or even in Italy. Italy has incredible riding, but the traffic is just so much more significant there and so much more stressful. You come to Girona and just it's that laid back Catalan vibe where people will just sit behind you in the car and not even care. They'll just wait. And then all of a sudden you'll go a K or two and you realize there's a car behind you and you just give them a wave, and they give you a wave and they drive by slowly without causing you stress. It's luxurious.
Do you have a test climb over in Girona that you like to do to know that you're in form?
Yes, I do. Rocca Corba, but it's not. It's not the only way I do it, though. In order to test my form, I call it my form finder. I do two. I tack it on at the end of a 6 to 7 hour ride, where I'll do two big climbs prior to it, and then go full gas on it. So I'll ride out to Olot, which is base for amazing climbing, really good climbs, and I'll do two big climbs out there that were roughly 30 minutes, one at kind of medium effort, and then one at like skies on the front, pinging it for the second last climb, where you're just riding 6 watts per kilo and everyone's just kind of on the rivet, and it whittles it down to 25 guys. Then I ride down to Rocca Corba and full gas. That's my big test.
And what's the sort of times at Rocca Corba?
Oh, I almost got Knoxy's time on it last year. James Knox has the record on it, 27:17. I think it was like 27:30.
And is Knoxy's the fastest time on it? Because you know you always hear like Wiggins rocked up and done it, but he didn't use Strava or whatever.
Yeah. I don't know what if the unofficial time is faster, but I actually do think Knoxy does have it. I'd heard that it was the high 27s, low 28s prior to Knox, and then Knox really knocked it out of the park with the 27:17. I actually was when I got close to him, I literally came by him with like 3K, sorry, K to go on the climb. He was just puttering up it, and I got to the top, and I was like, how fast are you going? And he was like, oh, I think I did 27:30 or something. I saw like 27:27 or something on my clock. And I was like, oh, I got you, buddy. And I went home, rode down the climb, rode home thinking I just got the comm and then uploaded to Strava and to only see that Knox still had it.
It's a stinking climb. I rode it last time I was over at Christmas. And there's a dude there now and he has a table out with drinks and refreshments halfway up, which is nice.
Yeah, it's lovely. It's necessary on those hot days for sure.
Oh, you tell me. Where's your passion at the moment? You know, when you get started in cycling, everything's new and everything is just fresh. And I was meant to chat with Christian Moore, I'm chatting with him tomorrow, and I was listening to a clip where he was talking about when he got started in cycling, he had this amazing passion for it, but towards the end of his career, his passion moved towards coffee. And he was so excited about going to coffee festivals and learning everything there was to learn about coffee. Is your passion, are you still full in cycling, or have you got one eye on kind of what's after cycling?
I definitely have one eye as to what's going on after cycling, just because I ruined one athletic career before, and I've always been terrified that this could end any day. And that only seems more relevant now than ever. I use Christian as a huge source of inspiration in that sense. The guy had 1 year left on his contract, but by that point had established such a strong business and such an influential business that he was able to leave it and focus on something that gave him just as much inspiration. So certainly I have some irons in the fire, and I've had to have a coaching business back home in Canada called Mile to Marathon that focuses more on running.
Nice.
But yeah, and it's gone quite well, and it's certainly something I want to take part in years to come. I'm also invested in the service course with Christian, and it's a business that I really believe in and would like to be a part of in the years to come as well.
Cool. Give that a bit of a shout out, because I've been to Girona, I don't know, 40 times or something stupid, but researching Christian and the concept of the service course, it's actually amazing, and I've only really used it as a bike shop, but tell us kind of what the concept of it is.
Yeah, well, I guess its genesis started from La Fabrica, and it's amazing going to the service course La Fabrica in Girona now. Well, just coming to Girona now, because prior to Christian and prior to La Fabrica, which is his coffee shop, there wasn't a good place to get coffee in Girona. Now after La Fabrica, Girona has, I don't know, 8, 9
amazing coffee
shops.
Now.
Yeah, it's just they're a dime a dozen. They're all quality, and that all started with Christian. I think it really is indicative of Christian's eye for business and his mind for business. And after creating La Fabrica, seeing the demand for having quality coffee in the area, but also the amount of cyclists just rolling in and enjoying coffee, I think Christian saw a whole. And I also saw an opportunity for also providing quality riding for those people enjoying his coffee. And so that's how the service course came about, creating this place where you can get all the amenities of being a pro cyclist, all the things that I get to enjoy and Christian enjoyed when he was on Orca Green Edge, now Mitchelton, also, yeah, enjoying those great things about Girona and then getting good coffee at the end too. So that's where Service Course was. It's not just a bike shop. It's a place where you can go in, meet some really good guides, have some great infrastructure around your rides, and yeah, just have this complete bike touring experience.
I'm lucky enough that I've had some amazing business mentors, but one of the really great pieces of advice I got was start at the finish line. Think about what success looks like, and then success leaves clues. Look at someone who's achieved what you want to achieve, and then figure out what they've done to get there and work backwards. Is there anyone you're kind of looking at and going, I like what he's done post-cycling?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean Christian is the perfect example of that. Even you know a guy like Simon Gerrans, who's now leading the service course from a business perspective. I have a lot of respect for guys that don't just hang it up. For me, the big part of life in general is pursuing something. It doesn't matter what it is, And I always have respect for guys who realize that their room for growth has expired within the realm of cycling and want to keep on pushing themselves and challenging themselves in something new and taking a bit of a risk. And so, yeah, Christian's a great example of that.
I've been chatting, lucky enough, the last few weeks to chat to some really cool cycling people, and a common trend everyone is talking about at the moment, it's what you in EF are calling alternate racing, but they're calling just gravel scene. You know, Tyler Hamilton's talking about it, Ian Boswell's talking about it, I was talking to Ted King yesterday, and obviously he loves it. Do you see yourself going into that afterwards?
Oh, yeah, certainly. I think it's one of the reasons why I'm proud to be on EF. Again, there's kind of a, like JV is another guy that has, that's kind of has his finger on the pulse and realizes where the sport's going. And I'm just tickled pink to be on this, literally, to be on the pink team.
Literally tickled pink.
Yeah, yeah. and to be kind of on the forefront of that. I think this is a team that, you know, 15, 20 years down the road, we're going to be looking back at and seeing them as a real influencer, a team that really changed, moved the needle and changed the sport. And I do see, you know, more participation races being playing a bigger role in cycling in the near future and even in the distant future, particularly with millennials and this generation of cyclists. People want to have more of an attachment to the racing that they're following. And that's where the gravel scene really comes into play.
See, obviously, your background is running. So just to draw a running analogy, marathon is just exploded. You know, we have 20,000 people or something to do the Dublin City Marathon. I know it's bigger numbers around the world. But there's such a detachment from marathon to track running. Are we looking at potentially having that same detachment between you guys and the World Tour and then these participatory events like Dirty Kanza?
Yeah, I mean that's a really good point. Something that I've thought long and hard on, and you're one of the few people who have kind of brought that up that I've talked to before I brought it up. But it's like running back in the '80s was at such an interesting point in the sense that you had a marathon scene really burgeoning. Like a burgeoning marathon scene, people starting to do Boston, starting to do New York, starting to do all these big marathons. But you also had a really strong track scene. You had characters like Seb Coe and Carl Lewis and big names. But the sport of athletics was never able to leverage it to connect the two. And now you see people doing a marathon. They can't tell you that you'll have, you know, 30,000 people do this one marathon. They can't tell you the name of the guy that won it.
Yeah, no clue.
They have no clue. They don't know what's going on in the World Athletic Championships. They're certainly not watching the marathon that takes place in the World Athletic Championships. And cycling's at that. I feel like it's at that point in the '80s now where you've got these big stars. But you've also got this burgeoning scene. And if cycling doesn't figure out a way to connect the two, then it's doomed to go the path of athletics, which is, as much as I hate to say it because I love the sport, it's dying. It's if not dead. I could see cycling really, if they don't capitalize on it, also being one of those kind of relic sports that people tune into every couple of years just because something interesting is going on, but not really following it throughout the year.
But I chatted with Ted King about this as well, and I think it's interesting where it's such a delicate tipping point at the moment, because what is cool about gravel is it's almost punk, it's countercultural, it's, you know, show up in a bunch race, use aero bars if you want. He said the rule is like, don't be a douche. You know, we all know aero bars are faster, but like, don't be a dick, don't use them, like, and that's the rule that governs it. But then you have all that's cool and countercultural there and it's kind of edgy. But then we have sort of your teammates, the EF boys, who seem like dudes, but they're going across to the gravel and there's nothing countercultural about World Tour. It's like, oh, is my saddle the right amount behind the bottom bracket? Is, you know, everything's matchy-matchy. And it's marrying those two worlds in a way that we can help sort of the rising tide lift both them and it doesn't sterilize gravel, I think, is the challenge.
Yeah, I think it's a challenge for sure. But I think there's also some countercultural aspects to cycling too that will always be there. I think it is, you know, it is a hard man sport. You've got to be tough. You've got to, you've got to be willing to eat shit, you know, like you got to be willing to crash. It's not pretty in a lot of ways. I'm sitting here with a broken femur. And I think if cycling can figure out a way to leverage those stories, like pro cycling can leverage those stories and connect them to the idea that in one thing that is most beautiful about the gravel races is this concept of facing adversity, challenging yourself, taking on your fears and really kind of pushing and recalibrating your what your perceived limits are. They can show that pro cyclists, that's what they do every day. I think that would be the saving grace for the sport.
I was chatting to Tyler Hamilton the other day, and then I was reading a Hunter S. Thompson after that. He's kind of, you probably know him, he's a sort of mythological status nearly as an American writer, but I found a quote and I was like,
yeah, one of my favorite writers, actually, if not my favorite writer.
You probably even know this quote, and I just thought, this just sums up cycling. And it's like, myths and legends die hard in America. We love them for the extra dimension they provide, the illusion of near infinite possibility to erase the narrow confines of most men's reality. Weird heroes and mold-breaking champions exist as living proof to those who need it that the tyranny of the rat race is not yet final. It just kind of sums up cycling, and more so the gravel movement for me. It's like, it's just such a cool quote.
What book is it from?
I think it, I'm actually not 100% sure. No, I'm not sure. I screen captured it, so I couldn't tell you what book it's from, but
cool.
It's one of those ones that's like, yeah, you know what? I'm going to say that when I chat to Mike once, because he's a dude and he'll understand. Mike, before we wrap up, sort of my goal with the podcast and coming back, I'm just trying to figure out how I keep on cycling and make a career out of cycling, so I don't have to go and enter into that, as Hunter Thompson called it, the rat race, because cycling to me is the antithesis of that. You strike me as a man who just loves riding his bike and is kind of on that same journey to just figure out how you can keep cycling a part of your life. Would that be fair?
100%. 100% true.
One of the parts of that that's, for me, I've kind of come up with this credo for the podcast, I suppose, and it's, how do I use cycling as a tool to achieve health, happiness, and longevity? And one of the things that's been very powerful for me, it's morning routines. I got a chance to, you know, travel around the world, speak with amazing high performers in different sports and business, but I tried to pull common traits from all their experiences. And one of the things I found was morning routine. So I tried to craft my own morning routine, where, you know, I'll get up in the morning, I'll have a cold shower, I do some photobiomodulation with this light unit, walk the dog, have a coffee, journal, meditate. It takes me about an hour total, and that'll be kind of my morning routine. Have you looked at routines, or is there any routines you use at the moment?
Yeah, I'm trying to get more into a routine at the moment, particularly just being in lockdown. I'm finding that I'm aimless if I don't have one. But yeah, I'm a huge believer in mindfulness and meditation and all those things. One thing that's also kind of thrown a wrench into the spokes of my morning routine is having a new baby, having a new baby girl. She's really determining our routine every morning now, and it's been tricky trying to figure out what that routine is. But once I figure out how to navigate that and get an idea of what her routine is, which seems to be no routine at the moment, hopefully I can get back on one and share that with you. But I don't have one at this very moment in time.
Mike, it has been a pleasure chatting with you. I know we're going to have piles of listeners going, Mike's a bit of a dude. I like him. I like the cut of his jib. Where can they follow you?
Well, I'm on Instagram, Rusty Woods, Rusty_Woods. And definitely anything EF related. If you go on EF Gone Racing or check out our website. There's tons of content on myself, but also some really interesting other guys that are kind of trying to pursue exactly what your life goal is. Guys like Lachlan Morton and Alex Howes who are really stuck into the alternative scene and just exploring their limits and trying to keep biking as a part of the rest of their life.
Amazing, Mike. Thanks for chatting.
Thanks for the time, man.
Oh, I thoroughly enjoyed that. I really did. It's almost corny to say it, but it is like a childhood fantasy getting to talk to these guys, getting to, you know, vicariously live that piece of action through them. It's absolutely amazing. What a story. When Mike was talking about 150 meters to go and he thought he could win the World Championships, I genuinely had goosebumps during that chat. Unbelievable stuff. Guys, thanks for listening this week. As always, we obviously are a coaching company. If you feel like you need guidance with your coaching, pop me an email, info@a1coaching.net, or head over to a1coaching.net and have a browse around the website. And don't forget Patreon. It's patreon.com/Anthony_Walsh. Buy me a pint, buy me a coffee. That's what makes the podcast tick. And I'm going to be back next week with another World Tour guest, another phenomenal guest. It's top class. You're going to love this one. I think it's the best episode yet. Chat to you next week.